I got over the border in very quick time, about the only time in my life that I have. But, he offered me a job and I could see by his aura that he was a reasonably honest man, as honest as he could afford to be, in other words. He told me that he needed to have cars taken to different locations, so I took his offer and it afforded me a truly wonderful opportunity of seeing Europe. He knew the location quite well and he had contacts. He looked at my papers and shuddered at the sight of them, telling me that I couldn't possibly get anywhere except prison if I had papers marked deportee. So he left me by the roadside for a time, after which he came back for me and drove me to a place I will not say, where I was fitted out with fresh papers, a forged passport, and all the necessary travel documents. So I drove for him. He seemed to be scared of driving, and it was fortunate for me that he was. I drove to Bratislava and on to Vienna. Vienna, I could see, had been a very wonderful city indeed, but now it was knocked about a lot because of the aftermath of war. We stayed there 2 or 3 days, and I looked around the city as much as I could, although it wasn't easy because the people were inordinately suspicious of foreigners. Every so often a person would sidle up to a policeman and there would be whispered conversation, and then the policeman would make sure his gun was in order and then he would approach me and demand papers. It gave me a good chance to check that my papers were quite authentic, because there was never any query at all about them. From Vienna we went to Klagenfurt. There was only a slight delay there. I waited about 8 hours and got thoroughly frozen in the drizzling rain which came teeming down. I also got quite hungry because there was rationing and I hadn't got the right sort of coupons. But hunger was a thing to which I was well accustomed, so I just put up with it. We drove through the night to Italy and made our way to Venice. Here, to my regret, I had to stay 10 days. Unhappy 10 days they were, too, because I am gifted or cursed with an absolutely exceptional sense of smell and, as possibly everyone knows, the canals of Venice are open sewers. After all, how can you have closed in sewers when the whole darn place is flooded? So it certainly was not a place to swim. The 10 days dragged. The place seemed to be full of Americans who were very full one of money and drink. It was an everyday sight for Americans to flash an immense roll of money which would have kept most of the Italians for a year. Many of the Americans, I was told, were deserters from the US Army or Air Force who had quite big businesses in black market goods. From Venice we went on to Padua, a place rich in history and redolent of the past. I spent a week here. My employer seemed to have a great amount of business to do and I was dazzled by the different girlfriends he picked up as other people pick flowers by the roadside. No doubt it was because he had such a big bankroll. In Padua my employer had a sudden change of plans, but he came to me one day and told me all about it, saying he had to fly back to Czechoslovakia. But there was an American, he said, who very much wanted to meet me, a man who knew all about me. So I was introduced to this man. He was a great beefy man with thick blubber lips, and a girlfriend who did not seem to mind whether she was draped or undraped. The American was another man dealing in cars, trucks, and various other types of machinery. I drove a big truck for a time in Padua. My load was different official cars, some taken from high-ranking Nazis and others from fascist officials who had lost life and cars. These cars well, I just could not understand what was happening to them, but they seemed to be exported to the USA where they fetched fabulous prices. My new employer, the American, wanted me to take a special car to Switzerland, and then take another car to Germany. But, as I explained, my papers were not good enough for that. He pooh-poohed my arguments, but then said, "Gee, I got the very thing for you. I know what we can do. 2 days ago a drunken American drove into a concrete abutment and he was splattered all over the place. My men got his papers before they were even touched by the blood which came out of him. Here they are." He turned and rifled through his big bulging briefcase and fished out a bundle of papers. I jumped to instant alertness when I saw that they were the papers of a ship's second engineer. Everything was there: the passport, the Marine Union card, work permits, money, everything. Only one thing was wrong: the photograph. The American laughed as if he would never stop and said, "Photograph. Come on with me, we'll get that done right away." He bustled me out of the hotel room and we went to some peculiar place which meandered down many stone steps. There were secret knocks on the door and sort of password, and then we were admitted to a sleazy room with a gang of men lounging around there. I could see at a glance that they were counterfeiters, although I couldn't tell what sort of money they were forging, but that was nothing to do with me. The problem was explained to them, and my photograph was speedily taken, my signature was taken as well, and then we were ushered out of the place. The following evening there came a knock on the hotel door and a man entered carrying my papers. I looked through them and I really could believe that I had signed the things and filled in all the details with my own handwriting, they were so perfect. I thought to myself, well, now I've got all the papers I should be able to get aboard a ship somewhere, get a job as an engineer and go off to the USA, that's where I have to be, the USA, so I'll do what this fellow wants in the hope I'll get to some big seaport. My new employer was delighted with my change of attitude, so the first thing he did was to give me a large sum of money and introduce me to a Mercedes car, a very powerful car indeed, and I drove that car to Switzerland. I managed to get through customs and immigration, and there was no trouble at all. Then I changed the car at a special address and continued on to Germany, actually to Karlsruhe, where I was told that I had to go on to Ludwigshafen. I drove there, and to my surprise found my American employer there. He was delighted to see me because he had had a report from his contacts in Switzerland that the Mercedes had been delivered without a scratch on it. I stayed in Germany for some 3 months. A little more than 3 months as a matter of fact. I drove different cars to different destinations, and frankly it simply did not make sense to me, I didn't know why I was driving these cars. But I had plenty of time to spare, so I made good use of it by getting a lot of books to study marine engines and the duties of a ship's engineer. I went to maritime museums and saw ship models and models of ship's engines. So at the end of 3 months I felt quite confident that I could turn my engineering knowledge to marine engineering also. One day my boss drove me out to a deserted airport. We drew up in front of a disused aircraft hangar. Men rushed to open the doors, and inside there was a truly weird contraption which seemed to be all yellow metal struts. The thing had 8 wheels and at one end was a truly immense coupe. Perched at the other end was a little glassed-in house. The driving compartment. My employer said, "Can you take this thing to Verdun?" "I don't see why not," I replied. "It's got an engine and it's got wheels, so it should be drivable." One of the mechanics there showed me how to start it and how to use it, and I practiced driving up and down the disused aeroplane runways. An officious policeman rushed into the grounds and announced that the thing could only be used at night and it would have to have a man at the rear end to watch out for coming traffic. So I practiced while a second man was found. Then, when I was satisfied that I knew how to make the machine move and, even more important, I knew how to make the thing stop, my lookout and I set off for Verdun. We could only drive by night because of German and French road regulations, and we could not exceed 20 miles an hour, so it was a slow journey indeed. I had time to watch the scenery. I saw the gutted countryside, the burned-out wrecks of tanks and aircraft and guns, I saw the ruined houses, some with only one wall still remaining. War, I thought, what a strange thing it is that humans treat humans so. If people only obeyed our laws there would be no wars. Our law, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. A law which would effectively prevent wars. But I saw some very pleasant scenery too, but I was not getting paid to admire the scenery, I was getting paid to get that clattering hunk of machinery safely to Verdun. At last we arrived at that city, and early in the morning before there was much traffic I drove it into an immense construction yard where we were expected. Here a very grim-looking Frenchman who seemed to be more or less square rushed out at me and said, "Now take this thing to Metz." I replied, "No, I have been paid to bring it here and I am driving it no further." To my horrified amazement he whipped out one of those awful knives which have a spring, you press a button and the blade slides out and locks in place. He came at me with that knife, but I had been well trained, I wasn't going to be stabbed by a Frenchman, so I did a little karate throw which sent him down on his back with one awful clatter. his knife spinning from his hand. For one awful moment he lay there dazed, then with a bellow of rage he jumped to his feet so fast that his feet were moving before they touched the ground, and he dashed into a workshop and came out with a 3-foot bar of steel used for opening crates. He rushed at me and tried to bring the bar down across my shoulders. I dropped to my knees and grabbed one of his legs, and twisted. I twisted a bit harder than I intended because his leg broke with quite a snap at the knee. Well, I expected to get arrested by the police at least. Instead, I was roundly cheered by the man's employees, and then a police car drove up with the police looking very grim indeed. When they were told what had happened, they joined in the applause, and to my profound astonishment they took me off for a good meal. After the meal they found accommodation for me, and when I was in that accommodation a man came along and told me that he had heard all about me and did I want another job. Of course I did, so he took me out to a cafe in which there were 2 elderly ladies obviously waiting for me. They were very, very old and very, very autocratic. They did a bit of the my man talk until I told them that I wasn't their man, I didn't want anything to do with them in fact. And then one of them laughed outright and said she really did admire a man with spirit. They wanted me to drive them in a very new car to Paris. Well, I was all for that. I wanted to go to Paris, so I agreed to drive them to Paris even though there was the stipulation that I must not exceed 35 miles an hour. That was no problem to me, I had just driven from Ludwigshafen at 20 miles an hour. I got the 2 old ladies safely to Paris and they paid me very well for the trip, and gave me many compliments on my driving. Actually they offered to take me in their service because they said they liked a man with spirit to be their chauffeur. But that was not at all what I wanted. My task had not yet been accomplished, and I did not think much of driving old ladies about at 35 miles an hour. So I refused their offer and left them to try to find another job. People with whom I left the old lady's car suggested accommodation for me, and I made my way there, arriving just as an ambulance arrived. I stood outside waiting for the commotion to end and I asked a man what it was all about. He told me that a man who had an important job taking furniture to Ken had just fallen and broken his leg, and he was worried because he would lose his job if he could not go or find a substitute. As he was carried out on a stretcher, I pressed forward and told him that I could do his job for him. The ambulance men halted a moment while we talked. I told him I wanted to go to that city, and if he could fix it he could get paid for the trip and I would go just to get that transport. He looked overjoyed in spite of the pain in his leg, and said that he would send a message to me from his hospital, and with that he was loaded into the ambulance and driven away. I booked in at the lodging house, and later that night a friend of the furniture remover came and told me that the job was mine if I would go to Ken and help unload furniture and load a fresh lot. The man, he told me, had accepted my offer that he would have the money and I would have the work. At the very next day, though, I had to be off again. We had to go to one of the big houses in Paris and load up this great Bantic Nikon. We did so the gardener of the estate and I because the driver was too lazy. He made excuse after excuse to leave. At last the Bantic Nikon was loaded and we departed. After we had done about a mile, or less, the driver stopped and said, "Here, you take on driving, I want to get some sleep." We shifted positions, and I drove on through the night. In the morning we were at Ken and drove to the estate where the furniture and luggage had to be unloaded. Again one of the house staff and I unloaded because the driver said he had to go elsewhere on business. In the late afternoon when all the work was done the driver appeared and said, "Now we must go on and load a fresh lot." I got into the driving seat and drove on as far as the main railroad station. There I jumped out, taking all my possessions with me, and said to the driver, "I've been working all the time, now you do some for a change." With that I went into the station and got a ticket for Cherbourg. Arrived at that city I wandered about a bit and eventually took a room at the Seaman's Lodgings in the dock area. I made quite a point of meeting as many ship's engineers as I could and making myself agreeable to them. So with a little prodding on my part I received opportunities to see their engine rooms aboard their ships, and I received many, many hints and pointers which could not easily be obtained from textbooks. Day after day I went to shipping agents showing my papers and trying to get a berth as second engineer on a ship going to the USA. I told them that I had come to Europe on vacation and had been robbed of my money and now I had to work my way back. There were many expressions of sympathy, and at last a good old Scottish engineer told me that he would offer me a job as third engineer going that night to New York. I went aboard the ship with him and down the iron ladders to the engine room. There he asked me many questions about the operation of the engines and about the keeping of records and watches. Eventually he expressed himself as entirely satisfied and said, "Come on up to the master's quarters, and you can sign the ship's articles." We did that and the ship's master looked a grim sort of fellow. I didn't like him at all, and he didn't like me either, but we signed the articles and then the ship's first engineer told me, "Get your dudge aboard, you take first duty, we sail tonight." And that was that. And so, very probably for the first time in history, a Lama of Tibet, and a medical Lama at that, posing as an American citizen, took a job aboard an American ship as third engineer. For 8 hours I stood engine room watch. The second was off duty, and the first engineer had work to do connected with leaving port, so I had to go immediately on duty without any opportunity to have a meal or even to change into uniform. But 8 hours duty in port was a blessing to me. It enabled me to get accustomed to the place, to investigate the controls, and so instead of being displeased and unhappy about it as the chief expected me to be, really I was well content. After the 8 hours was up, the chief engineer clattered down the steel ladder and formally relieved me of duty, telling me to go and have a good meal because, he said, I looked famished. And be sure, he commanded, to tell the cook to bring down cocoa for me. It was not a happy ship by any means. The captain and the first officer thought they were commanding a first-class liner instead of a beat-up old tramp steamer. They insisted on uniform, they insisted on inspecting one's cabin, an unusual thing aboard ship. No, it was not a happy ship indeed, but we thudded along across the Atlantic, rolling and swaying in the North Atlantic weather. At last we reached the lightship at the approach to New York Harbor. It was early morning and the towers of Manhattan seemed to be agleam with reflected light. I had never seen anything like this before. Approaching from the sea, the towers stood up like something out of one's fevered imagination. We steamed on down the Hudson and under a great bridge. There I saw the world-famed Statue of Liberty, but to my astonishment Liberty had her back to New York, had her back to the USA. This shocked me. Surely, I thought, unless America was going to take all and sundry, then the Liberty should be in the USA. We reached our berth after much shoving and towing by small tugs with a big M on the funnel. Then there was the roaring of motors. Great trucks arrived. The cranes started to work as a shore crew came aboard. The chief engineer came and begged me to sign on, offering me promotion to second engineer. But no, I told him, I had had enough of that ship. Some of the deck officers had indeed been an unpleasant lot. We went to the shipping office and signed off, and the chief engineer gave me a wonderful reference, saying that I had shown great devotion to duty, that I was efficient in all branches of engine room work, and he made a special note that he invited me to sign on again with him at any time in any ship because, he wrote, I was a great shipmate. Feeling quite warmed by such a farewell from the chief engineer and carrying my heavy cases, I went out of the docks. The din of traffic was terrible. There were shouting people and shouting policemen, and the whole place seemed to be absolutely mad. First I went to a ship's hostel, or, more accurately, it should be described as a seaman's hostel. Here again there was no sign of hospitality, no sign of friendship. In fact, with quite average politeness, I thought, I thanked the person for handing me the key to a room. He snarled back at me, "Don't thank me, I'm just doing my job, nothing more." 24 hours was the limit that one could stay in that hostel, 48 if one was going to join another ship. So the next day I picked up my cases again, went down in the elevator, paid off the surly reception clerk, and walked out into the streets. I walked along the street being very circumspect because I was, frankly, quite terrified of the traffic. But then there was a terrific uproar, cars sounding their horns, and a policeman blowing his whistle, and at that moment a great shape mounted the sidewalk, hit me and knocked me down. I felt the breaking of bones. A car driven by a driver under the influence of drink had come down a one-way street, and as a last attempt to avoid hitting a delivery truck had mounted the sidewalk and knocked me over. I awakened much later to find myself in a hospital. I had a broken left arm, four ribs broken, and both feet smashed. The police came and tried to find out as much as they could about the driver of the car as if I had been his bosom friend. I asked them about my two cases and they said quite cheerily, "Oh no, as soon as you were knocked down, before the police could get to you, a guy slithered out of a doorway, grabbed your cases and went off at a run. We didn't have time to look after him, we'll got to get you off the sidewalk because you were obstructing the way." Life in the hospital was complicated. Because of the rib injuries, I contracted double pneumonia and for 9 weeks I lingered in that hospital, making a very slow recovery indeed. The air of New York was not at all like that to which I was accustomed, and everyone kept all the windows closed and the heat turned on. I really thought I was going to die of suffocation. At last I made enough recovery to get out of bed. After 9 weeks in bed I was feeling dreadfully weak. Then some hospital official came along and wanted to know about payment. She said, "We found $260 in your wallet and we shall have to take $250 of that for your stay here. We have to leave you $10 by law, but you'll have to pay the rest." She presented me with a bill for over $1,000. I was quite shocked and complained to another man who had come in after her, a man who appeared to be some senior official. He shrugged his shoulders and said, "Oh well, you'll have to sue the man who knocked you down. It's nothing to do with us." To me that was the epitome of foolishness, because how could I trace the man when I hadn't seen him? As I said, I had more money in my cases, and the only reply was, "Well, catch the man and get your cases back from him." Catch the man after 9 weeks in hospital, and after the police apparently had failed to make any worthwhile attempt to catch him. I was quite shocked. But I was to be shocked even more. The man, the senior official, produced a paper and said, "You are being released from hospital now because you have no money for any further treatment. We can't afford to keep you foreigners here unless you can pay. Sign here." I looked at him in shock. Here was I, the first day out of bed for 9 weeks, I had had broken bones and double pneumonia, and now I was being turned out of hospital. There was no sympathy, no understanding. And instead I was literally, and I mean this quite literally, turned out of hospital, and all I had was a suit of clothes I was wearing and a $10 bill. A man in the street to whom I explained my problem jerked a thumb in the direction of an employment agency, and so I went there and climbed up many stairs. At last I got a job with a very, very famous hotel indeed, a hotel so famous that almost anyone in the world will have heard of it. The job washing dishes. The pay $20 a week and one meal a day, and that one meal a day was not the good stuff that guests had, but the bad stuff left by guests or which was not considered fit for the guests. On $20 a week I could not afford a room, so I did not bother about such things. I made my home wherever I happened to be, trying to sleep in a doorway, trying to sleep beneath a bridge or under an arch, with every so often the prod of a policeman's nightstick in my ribs, and a snarling voice bidding me to get out of it and keep moving. At last, by a stroke of luck, I obtained a job with a radio station. I became a radio announcer, talking to the whole world on the short waves. For 6 months I did that, and during those 6 months I obtained from Shanghai papers and belongings which I had left with friends there. The papers included a passport issued by the British authorities at the British concession. But, as I began to feel, I was wasting my time as a radio announcer. I had a task to do, and all I was earning now was $110 a week, which was a great advance over $20 a week and one meal, but I decided to move on. I gave the radio station adequate time to obtain a suitable replacement for me, and when I had trained him for 2 weeks I left. Fortunately I saw an advertisement wanting people to drive cars, So I answered the advertisement and found that I could take a car and drive it all the way to Seattle. There is no point in recounting the journey now, but I drove safely to Seattle and got a bonus for careful driving and for turning in the car without a single scratch on it. And then I managed to go on to Canada. So ends the second book, The First Era. Book 3, The Book of Changes. Let not thy sorrows obtrude onto those who have left this world of man. Name no names, for to name those who have passed beyond this realm is to disturb their peace. Wherefore it is that those who are mourned suffer greatly from those who mourn. Let there be peace. It also makes good sense, the law of libel being what it is. Wherefore I say unto you, names shall not be named. Pax Vobiscum, Chapter 7. There is little point in describing how I made my way through Canada, all the way through the Rocky Mountains, and all along to Winnipeg, to Thunder Bay, Montreal, and Quebec City. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people have done that. But I did have some unusual experiences which I may yet write about, although that is not for this moment. In my journey through Canada, it was borne upon me that I should make my way to England. I was convinced that the task which I still had to do had to start in England, a little place which I had seen only from afar from the porthole of a ship leaving Cherbourg and heading out into the English Channel before turning for the USA. In Quebec I made inquiries and managed to obtain all necessary papers such as passport, work permit, and all the rest. I also managed to obtain a Seaman's Union card. Again, there is no point in going into details of how I obtained these things. I have in the past told bureaucrats that their stupid system of red tape only strangles people who have all papers legitimately. In my own case I state emphatically that the only time I have had any difficulty at all entering a country was when my papers were in order. Here in Canada, when I used to be more mobile and could go to the USA, there was always difficulty with my papers. There was always something wrong, something for the immigration officer to quibble about. So, bureaucrats are parasites who should be eliminated like lice. Hey! That would be a good idea, too, wouldn't it? I made my way back to Montreal and there, with my papers perfectly in order, I was able to get aboard a ship as a deckhand. The pay was not wonderful, but my own idea was that I wanted to get to England, and I had no money for a ticket. Therefore any pay was better than having to pay. The work was not too hard, it consisted merely of rearranging cargo and then knocking wedges into hold covers. Soon we were steaming up the English Channel, and not too long after we turned into the Solent on our way to Southampton. I was off duty at the time and was able to sit in the stern and look out across the English scenery, which attracted me considerably. The English scenery seemed to me to be of the greenest of greens. At that time I had not seen Ireland which can beat the English scenery any time, and so I was quite entranced. The military hospital at Netley intrigued me vastly. I thought from the water that it must be the home of a king or someone of such status, but a member of the crew with quite a loud laugh soon told me that this was just a hospital. We went up past Woolston on the right, and Southampton on the left. I was interested to see at Woolston the home of a super marine flying boats which were making very much of a name for themselves in the Far East. Soon we docked in Southampton, and officials came aboard, checked the ship's papers and examined the crew's quarters. Finally we were given clearance to go ashore and I was on the point of leaving but was called back for immigration check once again. The officer looked at my papers and was very friendly and approving when, in answer to his question, "How long are you staying?" I replied, "I am going to live here, sir." He put the necessary stamps on the passport and gave me directions for seamen's lodgings. I walked out of the immigration office and stood for a moment taking a last look at the old freighter on which I had arrived from the New World to the old. A customs officer started to move across with a smile on his face, and then suddenly there was a stunning blow at my back and I reeled against the wall, dropping my two cases as I did so. Gathering my scattered wits, I turned around and saw a man sitting at my feet. He was a senior customs officer who had been hurrying to work and had misjudged his distance trying to get in the door. I went to help him up and he struck my outstretched hands with a fury of hatred. I recoiled in complete astonishment. The accident was not my fault, I was just standing there inoffensively. But I picked up my cases to move on when he yelled at me to stop. He called two guards to detain me.